You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Oh, that was the best joke ever.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, my God. Oh, wait. Hey, how are you guys? Thanks for coming out. This is The Real Short Box. My name is Donald.
I'm Jared. I'm having a great time.
And I am the righteous podcaster, Kevin.
Oh, he's so goddamn righteous. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of righteous, we are here for the second part due of our Bronze Age discussion of Marvel comic books.
That's right.
Now, this is a very intense discussion mm-hmm. we've been having here, and actually we've been having pre-discussions before discussions, and there was an arm wrestling contest, and whoever speaks next is going to be the winner. Just so you guys know, this is the winner of the arm wrestling contest.
Sweet Christmas.
Of all people, the winner was Jared.
Yeah,
it's my albino Filipino strength, you see. Yep. So what we're going to talk about now is, like we were talking about before with the Bronze Age, was that the floodgates of creativity and exploration opened for Marvel. Like a waterfall, and a beautiful waterfall. We talked about last episode the comics code getting kind of beaten down like the little bitch that it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about how the influx of horror titles came back to just pump new blood into the Marvel Universe. Now, what was also cool is it's a catch-22. So Marvel had... Marvel was trying everything. And when I said they're trying everything, whatever was hot in the media, in movies, in music...
In culture,
they wanted to mirror in their comic books, because that's, you know, society. They wanted to show what society was into. They, you know, for marketing reasons and for creative reasons. Now, one of the biggest aspects of that was the bringing in of multicultural heroes, and specifically African-American black characters were coming straight into the Marvel Universe. And one of my favorites was at the forefront, and his name was Mr. Luke Cage.
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys remember? Yeah. Do you guys know his real name?
Yeah.
Mike Coulter.
No, not the actor who plays him on the show. No, Carl Lucas.
That's right, Carl Lucas.
Yeah, that's a good trivia question for you. Now, Luke Cage was created during the height of the black exploitation genre, as we know, like Shaft, The Mac, all those movies, which...
The Legend of... I'm not going to finish it.
Of Korra?
No. Kevin's eyes are bugged out. Guys, just type in blaxploitation movies and then in parentheses put The Legend of and just see what pops up.
Right. Well, now these movies, like blaxploitation movies were, it was a mix because it was showing black empowerment and at the same time it was also showing a lot of stereotypes.
Like, parody, yeah.
Right. So
jive talk.
Right. A lot of jive talk. So, and the Luke Cage.
Well, there was a lot of jive talkers and jive people back then.
That's right.
These turkeys needed it.
Jive talking.
I mean, in the Luke Cage comics alone, how many times did he say jive turkeys?
Jive turkeys and his famous catchphrase, Sweet Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Which there's a whole backstory to, but it's still very random. It's just a weird quote. Sweet Christmas. So he was created during the height of this black exploitation genre. Luke Cage is an ex-convict in prison for a crime he did not commit,
mm-hmm.
who gains the powers of superhuman strength and what he's very much known for, his unbreakable skin, after being subjected voluntarily to an experimental procedure. Now, once freed, Cage becomes a hero for hire. Now, if you read these early books, the first, the first, I think, 12 issues, it's Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, then it goes to Power Man, I love Luke Cage. The first issues are great. And yes, there is a lot of stereotypes, but he's still the hero of the book. And
he's cleaning up the streets.
And there's stereotypes on all levels. Like the cop, like one of the main cops who's like a corrupt cop, looks like, if you look at him, his nose kind of is a little upturned like a pig. Kind of looks a little piggy. I smell bacon. The cop's a pig! But, sorry, but no. So, like, the cops are all, you know, all the white people are pretty much horrible. And
you know, I had a BLT today for lunch.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So that I might have eaten my cousin. He was a cop.
Now, Luke Cage, Hero Fryer, initially written by Archie Goodwin and art by John Romita Sr., the great. It was retitled Luke Cage Power Man with issue number 17.
So they didn't skimp on the writer or the artist.
Yeah. No, no. And it was fairly consistent from what I remember. Okay. So they actually really cared about the story. And if you read it, it still, to this day, holds up. Luke Cage, Hero for Hire.
Oh, yeah.
All the way to Power Man and all the way to Power Man and Iron Fist.
Right. I read some of the latter ones, Power Man and Iron Fist. They're just fun.
They're so fun. It's just great comic book reading. His adventures were set in a grungier, more crime-dominated New York City, specifically Harlem. Than that inhabited by the other Marvel superheroes of the time. So you had Daredevil in Hell's Kitchen, but this was the one guy who was in Harlem, and rightfully so. Now, as the black exploitation genre popularity faded, Cage became unable to support his own series and was paired with a certain martial artist superhero who we will get to in a little bit, because the way they tie into each other is pretty cool as far as the historical aspect of Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I chose three characters as far as the African-American characters that I wanted to talk about for Marvel, because I feel they represent all different genres and interpretations of black people in comic books. The other one I chose was more of an obscure one. That was Bill Foster, a.k.a. Black Goliath, also known as the Second Giant Man. He wasn't from the streets, and he wasn't from the blaxploitation avenue was done, and they had to use that up. This guy was he was born in Watts, Los Angeles, California. He was a biochemist. Dr. Bill Foster works in the plans and research division for some guy named Tony Stark's Baltimore factory.
What?
Mm.
So he is hired to be the biochemical laboratory assistant of Dr. Henry Hank Pym.
Nice.
Pym, also known as Giant Man. Pym is struck at the height of, is stuck at the height of 10 feet for a time. Man, I am stuck at 10 feet.
Imagine if he shrunk back down and his dick just stayed the size.
He's like, this isn't as cool as you would think.
Yeah.
So Pym was stuck at 10 feet for a time. At the behest of Stark, Dr. Foster helps Pym find a cure to change his size back to normal. Foster continues to work as Pym's lab assistant. That's racist. Foster later investigates the seeming deaths of Pym and Janet Van Dyne. Now let's get to the Black Goliath stuff.
Did you know that the guys, there's a record holder for the world's largest penis. And his penis, I believe, is either 12 or 13 inches or something like this.
Still alive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But every time he gets an erection, he faints. Because all the blood goes out of his head and goes into his dick.
So he doesn't have sex much.
No.
Or he can't.
Yeah. So imagine you've got the world's largest penis.
And you can't use it.
Right. Isn't that the saddest goddamn story you've
ever
heard?
That's like some like weird curse from an enchantress or something. Like, you didn't have sex with me when I was an old hag. And now I'm beautiful. I'm going to give you the greatest big cock. But you'll never fuck with
it. You'll never.
Can't he get a reduction?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know if I'd ever want to put my penis under a knife like that. I mean, I know you've recently got implants, so yours could be about 5 inches, but still.
Wow.
Let's get back to this Black Goliath.
I'm kidding. Yes.
Yes. You like that?
I do. That's a good segment.
Dr. Foster moves to the West Coast and at some point acquires the formula to Pym particles, which give him the ability to grow in size like his former employer. Taking the name Black Goliath, he helps Power Man fight the circus of crime. That's right. So his first appearance was in a Power Man book, which was, go get that one. Mm-hmm. He later battles Atom Smasher, not from DC. The second Vulcan. Yeah, these guys are all over the place. I totally remember these guys. Oh, but I do know this one. And Stiltman. The mercenary Warhawk kills Atom Smasher and flees before Black Goliath can catch him. He later goes on. This character would go on to, I think his series, let's see how... series ran from, it wasn't that long, it was a short series, and once again another one, but he got his own title. Oh, and his first appearance, by the way, is Black Goliath Power Man 24. Get that. But what was cool about this character is, yes, he's a legacy character in some aspects, but he was a scientist. He had nothing to do. They did, yes, tie him with Watts, the ghetto, and stuff like that, but at least he was somebody coming out of the ghetto and going into a much different life and persevering. He would guest star in The Champions of Los Angeles, which is a hilarious book, just one of the most random teams in the world. Defenders. He would go in there. I believe he was killed, unless they brought him back, but he was killed in the Civil War story. Remember that? The, like, android Thor, like, threw a hammer and, like, impaled him, and everybody was like, what the fuck? Yep. Like, why did he do that? And they found out it was an android.
I do remember that, because he was on Captain America's side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, that was fucked up, guys. Yep, that's right. I got a picture of it here. It's beautiful. Just, I know he blasts him. He blasts his lightning through his heart. Yep. That's not nice.
No. They had to bury him, too, with using, like, a backhoe and stuff, because he was still... Yeah, he was still enlarged, so they had to create this huge tomb.
Is he in the Marvel handbook?
Black Alive?
Black Alive, he should be.
Yeah, of course he is.
Yeah, he's a legit... He's like a C-list.
He ain't no slouch.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have him on my team.
Yeah.
He's a smart guy. He can grow really well. It's like having a little Hank Pym, you know?
Little Hank Pym.
Yeah. Pym in your pocket. Pocket Pym.
Now, Now, another character who was of more of the supernatural side is Mr. Brother Voodoo.
There we go.
That's right. Mr. Jericho Drum. What a great
drums.
Name.
The drums. First, you would hear them before he appeared.
Before he appears, yeah. First appearance, Strange Tales 169. Brother Voodoo, let's see, starred in his own feature in the Marvel comic book series Strange Tales from number 169 to 173. And in a backup feature in the black and white horror comics magazine, Tales of the Zombie number 6. These were all in the 70s, 74, 75. He has gone on to guest star very sporadically in other Marvel series. I know Donald's showing us his first appearance right now. Beautiful. He had a great costume with the kind of like a vest and the green spandex. And his costume was like all over the place.
It was really cool. It was like a V.
It looks like the Iron Fist pants a little bit. If you look
Iron
at
Fist
it.
Pants with like...
A diamond, like a white V,
a V
strip.
Strip vest.
Across his chest. Yeah. And then green diamonds like down each side.
Right.
It's very interesting. And then he's got like this gold band thing around his bicep on his right arm.
And now he had, I mean... His powers are endless. He couldn't afford
shoes. He's barefoot in this. So.
Well, no, he was one with the earth, you know?
True.
Straight up voodoo style. Returning to his native Haiti, he was originally born in Port-au-Prince. He went there to practice as an accredited psychologist. In the United States, Jericho Drum discovers that his twin brother, Daniel Drum, the local Hungan, is dying, a victim of a voodoo sorcerer who claims to be possessed by the spirit of the serpent god, Dambala.
Mm-hmm.
Just before he dies, Daniel makes his brother vow to visit Daniel's mentor, Papa Jumbo. Jericho does and becomes Jumbo's student. After studying under the aged Hungan for several weeks, Jericho gains a greater mastery of voodoo practices. Now, this is very much Doctor Strange and the Ancient One, but voodoo.
Yeah.
It's pretty much almost the same story, like a psychologist, a surgeon.
So he could be Sorcerer Supreme himself, if he wanted to be.
He became Sorcerer Supreme at one point. He
did. Yeah. Ramada did the artwork for this, or the cover at least.
Ramita, you mean.
Ramada, whatever.
The Ramada Inn, the workers of the Ramada Inn did the cover.
They all got together, banded together and did the artwork for this Strange Tales.
No, but Brother Voodoo is a character I love because he's one of those, another kind of C-lister, but he still sticks around. Like, I love that, like, artists pay tribute back to these characters and bring them in. And like, we're saying...
I love that he was Sorcerer Supreme.
Yeah, he took on as the Sorcerer Supreme.
He deserves a TV series.
Right.
Yes, he does. Netflix.
Bring him in somehow.
Netflix.
Yeah, he would be great for Netflix. Oh my God, if they did like a straight up like horror voodoo story with guy with like the magic shit, I'd be down.
Yep.
Now, so that's where I'm going to leave off with the blaxploitation or the influx of African-American characters into Marvel. I feel there's a good representation of the ones of that time of the Bronze Age. Now, what also was happening, like I said, Marvel liked to cash in on whatever was the big boom at the time. There was a big kung fu boom.
Ooh. Yeah.
This TV show, Kung Fu, Bruce Lee movies
Bruce Lee,
were huge.
And then his brother, Jim.
Jim Lee, the artist. A lot of people don't know about that. Yeah. Now, one of the premier characters of that was Shang-Chi, master of kung fu.
If there ever was a character that I would not think would be relevant right now, that would be him.
Right.
But by God, that thing, speaking of prospecting, that thing sells.
Special Marvel Edition number 15, one of my most prized possessions because it's in immaculate condition. Mm-hmm. It's also one of those random books that you would never have thought to, like, keep nice.
Yeah.
Is Shang-Chi's first appearance. The character was conceived in late 1972. Marvel had wished to acquire the rights to adapt the Kung Fu television program.
David Carradine?
As I was saying, yeah, but were denied permission by the show's owner. No, you can't. Time Warner, owner of DC Comics. Oh, so that's why. Because it was Time Warner.
Yeah.
They're like, nope, sorry. You are our nemesis.
Mm-hmm. See, now DC's learning stuff.
That's right. Marvel acquired the comic book rights to Zack Romer's pulp villain, Dr. Fu Manchu, instead. They developed Shang-Chi, a master of Kung Fu, who was introduced as a previously unknown son of Fu Manchu. Though an original character himself...
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Many of Shang-Chi's supporting characters, most notably Fu Manchu and Sir Dennis Nayland Smith, though that's not a pretentious name, were Romer's creations. No character from the Kung Fu television series carried over to the comic series, though the character Lu Sung, in an early issue, bears a strong resemblance to Kwai Chang Kang with the addition of a mustache.
Boy, they really are going with some stereotypes on the Asian side, too. My goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know.
Now, as I said, Shang-Chi first appeared in Marvel Special Edition number 15, written by Steve Englehart and art by Jim Starlin. That's cool.
Nice.
Jim Starlin's always good.
Steve Englehart, too. He's a solid writer.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of Marvel in the 80s, too.
Yeah. He was huge in the 80s, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that went to Special Marvel Edition 1 through 14 were reprints of older Marvel superhero stories. Shang-Chi appeared again in issue 16, and with issue number 17, this is when the title was changed to The Hands of Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu.
Yes.
Now, there was a lot of Kung Fu characters introduced at this time. There was White Tiger, the Daughters of the Dragon. There was the magazine, Deadly Hands of Kung Fu, which those are, from a prospecting position, are pretty cool to get because they're hard to find in good condition.
Yeah.
And they're just cool looking books. I'm always 50-50 split on collecting magazines because you got to keep them in their own kind of thing, their own bags and boards and their own like boxes and stuff. Like
right.
That.
Yeah. It's tough. Yeah, definitely. I found that it works best to keep those in with like other more expensive books that you want to put in the harder cases.
Right.
Because they're a little too wide for the slim short boxes.
Right.
So if you get like the double wide short boxes, they still fit in there and they're not going to get hurt anyway, even if they fall back and forth because they're in those harder cases.
Right.
So putting them in there is how I get around it. But still, yeah, it's kind of a pain in the butt.
Right. So as I was saying, he did several crossovers with other Marvel martial artists, including White Tiger, Iron Fist Daughters of the Dragon, which included Colleen Wing, who we just saw in the Iron Fist TV show.
Did we?
And did we? She was probably the only decent thing about that.
You know, there was a really great, and I mean great, short that they did on Iron Fist. It's up on YouTube now. It's called Iron Fisted.
Oh, yeah, you guys should check that out. It's actually, like, what Netflix really wanted to do
right.
with the show, but they couldn't. So, yeah, go see Iron Fisted by Rumble Spoon Productions.
Yeah.
Strangely, you could find it on our page, The Real Short Box, I believe you can find it there.
Yeah, we definitely have advertised for them. They're great people over there.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And that was a plug, yes. Speaking of Danny Rand, let's talk about Iron Fist. Mr. Danny Rand first appeared in Marvel Premiere number 15. Now, that book has probably gone up and down now, right?
Yeah, I'd imagine.
It's just fluctuated.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a solid book. Iron Fist, the character in the comics, is awesome. I will say that flat out. He's great. That Netflix series was just a heap of garbage.
Finn Jones, you don't feel he did an excellent job?
No.
Well, what I did not get is you had this all planned out. They knew they were doing Daredevil. They knew they were doing Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist. You had all that time to prepare an actor or find an actor that had martial arts skills or train them as best you can. But from all intents and purposes,
they rushed
the shit out of that. Like, I don't even blame him.
Yeah,
like,
he said he had, what, 20 minutes between each shoot take?
He said he went there for, like, I think a couple weeks before and, like, did as intensive as he could of training and then literally was learning fight stuff before they would shoot it. Mm-hmm. You just had all that time to plan it. I don't get why that was... Because Daredevil... The fight scenes are off the charts. Like, they're amazing. They're great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get that.
Well, the Defenders, they have a chance to make up for it.
I blame the director.
Right.
And that's what you get when you hire subpar.
Now, Iron Fist, along with the previously created Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu, came from Marvel Comics during an American pop culture trend in the early mid-70s of martial arts heroes. Writer, co-creator Roy Thomas wrote in a text piece in Marvel Premiere number 15 that Iron Fist's origin and creation owe much to the 1940s Bill Everett character Amazing Man. That's cool. Thomas later wrote that he and artist co-creator Gil Kane had, quote, started Iron Fist because I'd seen my first Kung Fu movie even before a Bruce Lee one came out, and it had a thing called the Ceremony of the Iron Fist in it. I thought that was a good name, and we already had Master of Kung Fu going, but I thought maybe a superhero called Iron Fist, even though we had Iron Man, would be a good idea. Publisher Stan Lee liked the name, so I got a hold of Gil, and he brought in his Amazing Man influences, and we designed the character together. Now, debuting in the story written by Thomas and penciled by Kane in the umbrella title Marvel Premiere number 15 through 25, he was then successfully written by Len Wein, Doug, what is it, Minch, Monch, Melinch, Munchies.
Munchies,
yeah. Tony Isabella and Chris Claremont.
I always call him Monek.
Monek?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's right either, but you know, it sounds nice. I'm going to say Munchie. Or you can go Doug Munch.
Right. So basically what I want to skip to is, yes, he had his run. There was an Iron Fist. They kept him going for a while with in the Marvel premieres. But to rescue the character from cancellation, Marvel paired Iron Fist with another character who was no longer popular enough to sustain his own series, who we just talked about, Mr. Luke Cage. This is the meeting of the two genres, but then creating their own epic team-up.
It's a beautiful mix.
Right. The two characters were partnered in a three-part story in Cage's series, Power Man number 48 through 50. The title of the series changed to Power Man and Iron Fist with issue number 50, although this did not reflect the change until issue number 67, as far as the title.
Yeah.
Iron Fist co-starred in the series until the final issue, number 125, in which he was killed off. Spoiler, he wasn't killed off. He's back. That Power Man and Iron Fist is one of my favorite books that I can go back in time and read, and it holds up.
It does. Yeah. It really, really does. I hate reading older books because they're just so riddled with dialogue and bullshit.
Some of them are way
backstory.
Too worried, or exposition.
As Peter Parker walked to the alley, you know, just draw him walking to the alley. You know, I don't need to know. God damn it. So, you know, like, there's just too much shit.
Now they have those, like, pages where it kind of says previously in this issue. Before, though, they did, like, two pages of, like, and this is what happened. And they just pretty much regurgitated the last issue. And you're
with
like,
all the shit. And you're like, come on. But these guys, when I not more than a couple of years ago, I bought my first issue of the old series. Mm-hmm. And it was like issue 109 or 110 or something. And they went to, I think it was Saudi Arabia or one of those countries where they went to investigate something. And I can't remember what it was. But it was just fun.
Yeah.
It was a fun issue. And it was very readable. It was a fast read. Mm-hmm. It got to the point. The action was good. It was just what you would want and more, I think.
Well, it's just fun. They were technically like good guy mercenaries because they were heroes for hire.
Yeah.
Danny Rand was super rich. He didn't need the money, but they teamed up together. And then it was just the perfect combo of superhero. You had a karate guy with his Iron Fist power, and then you had a guy who was like indestructible, super strong tank guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they both had already established cool personalities, and somehow they meshed. Like, to me, it seemed like just like almost like, and it sounds like it, they're kind of like, what if we just throw those guys together and see if they help? And it was like this weird, like, cookies and cream moment. Like, just work together. Yeah. Reese's Pieces, guys. Chocolate and peanut butter. Who fucking knew?
Yeah, I hate Reese's Pieces, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Shame on you. What about Reese's Peanut Butter Cups?
I love Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Yeah.
What about Fig Newtons?
Wait. You're getting off the chocolate peanut butter situation.
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
I will agree. I would take a peanut butter cup over Pieces any day.
Thank you.
But, I was just like, did you not like the chocolate peanut butter mix?
Well, I didn't like the candy shell, I thought. It was too much.
It is too much. Yeah. You know what? I agree with you.
Yeah, just chocolate peanut butter.
So, yeah, that's where I'm going to leave it with that, because I kind of thought that was a cool culmination of the Blaxploitation characters and the Kung Fu characters, and now they actually ended up together.
So we had chocolate enrobed in peanut butter, and now we have dark chocolate talking about... What is it, Kevin?
A blonde girl.
You know what? That's very true. I'm now going to discuss a more darker topic that happened during this era, and that was a shocking story of the death of Gwen Stacy.
Oh, Debbie Downer over here.
Yeah. Yes.
To this day, still prevalent in comic books.
Absolutely. Yeah,
very tragic.
Very tragic. And in fact, this was a very defining defining issue in the life of Spider-Man, of Peter Parker in particular, because... Mm-hmm. This, no one saw it coming.
Right.
No one saw it coming.
Mm-mm.
Amazing Spider-Man number issue 121 and 122. It's basically everything took place in issue 121 with her death. But basically no one saw this coming in the sense that the Green Goblin hadn't really murdered anyone yet.
Right.
You know, he was torture. You know, Peter Parker. He found his identity. Messed with his life.
Yeah.
But this is something where Stan Lee, well, actually not really Stan Lee in particular, it was really John Romita Jr., Roy Thomas, and Jerry Conway. They came up with the idea of killing off Gwen Stacy. And they asked Stan Lee before he took a trip to Europe if they can do it. And according to Stan Lee, he wasn't really paying attention. He was just trying to pack his bags to take this trip to Europe.
I think Stan Lee at this time was just like, Marvel was booming, and he was just catching planes all the time. And guys were like, hey, we want to do this. He's like, yeah, sure.
Pretty much. Like, sure,
go ahead. Excelsior.
Excelsior.
Yeah, it's like, sure, go ahead.
Give me another line.
Yeah. But technically, though, the Green Goblin didn't really kill Gwen Stacy, right?
No, technically, he's the cause of death, but he technically didn't do it. Technically, it was actually Peter.
Right.
Who killed her.
So Peter's a murderer.
Yes, by unintentionally.
So this is the important part of the issue where he actually kills his own girl.
The guilt trip.
Okay. But as if he didn't have enough guilt already.
Right.
The thing is, for the poor guy, there's nothing he could have done about it. She was doomed either way.
I think Mary Jane needs to die now.
It'll happen in due time.
Okay.
Yeah, essentially, the most famous part of this whole issue is essentially the kidnapping of Gwen Stacy by Green Goblin. They're at the Brooklyn Bridge. He tosses her over. Peter sends a webbing to catch her. He thinks he saved her, but he didn't realize that the whiplash ended up breaking her neck when he caught her with the webbing.
Which is like a super real thing.
Yes.
Like it's like,
and that's the thing. They wanted to go realistic here, you know, as a way to really show.
Has he never done that before up until this point, though? You have to imagine. Like, you're in 100 plus issues already.
Right.
For him to have not caught somebody with their webbing that was falling seems kind of ridiculous.
Well, we would always create like little hammocks and stuff like that. And
yeah.
Like, little nets.
I guess maybe.
Spur of the moment.
Shock. Possible, yeah. You could have gotten away with that not having happened before, but it just seems very unlikely.
Now, you were saying this was Stanley was on his way, and he was just like, yeah, but didn't know what he said yes to.
Right. Didn't know what he said yes to until after the fact when the issues were released. And then he was like, wait, why'd you guys kill her off for? Well, we asked you, and you said yes. Like,
right.
Oh, okay.
I think he was pissed too because they had already killed her father.
Yes.
Captain Gwen Stacy.
Captain Stacy. That's true.
That guy's got a girl's name.
Yeah. I will name my daughter Gwen because it makes sense for her.
It never made sense for me.
Yes, and after poor Gwen was killed, obviously Peter, rightfully so. I mean, if you think about it, Gwen Stacy was like the real, just true love because she was kind of nerdy like him, kind of related to him.
Mm-hmm.
And this really obviously affected him. And also Mary Jane, it affected her too. That was like one of her
close
friends.
She did anal. And none of the girls before were doing that
this
for him.
Was
I
not,
don't
that
know
would,
about that.
Now I know for a fact that would not pass the comics code.
No.
Because I proposed that. Same story.
I don't know where this is coming from, but okay.
I can tell you where it'd be going.
But yes, poor Gwen Stacy. It was such a tragedy. And then the very next issue, Spider-Man was about to kill Norman Osborn. He had him beat him an inch of his life. But of course, Peter being Peter, he just couldn't do it. And then right as he was giving him mercy, he launched a glider at Peter to try to impale him. But of course, using his Spidey sense, got out the way and ended up impaling himself.
Which is what they did in the movie.
Spider-Man movie, yes. So it was a very tragic. You saw two major important characters killed off in this two-issue story arc.
Yeah, that was pretty ballsy.
And it was very significant because you never really... It'd be kind of like if Lois Lane was killed off in Superman.
She was. Well, sort of.
Injustice. That's right.
Yes. But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like,
I know what
you're saying. Regular continuity is almost like at some random Superman issue, they just killed Lois Lane off. It'd be like, oh my God. Or even better, can you imagine that? Superman's trying to save Lois, but he ends up breaking her neck by mistake.
Right.
You know, like Lex Luthor.
I can't imagine that.
Well, he did kill her.
In Injustice.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, also you also would probably, I mean, as a fan reading that book, if you were reading it from, like, the get-go, you would already have gone, like, Uncle Ben already died. Like, this guy doesn't need any more guilt situations.
Yeah,
well,
there's no more rights.
It's funny you mentioned that. Jerry Conway talked about that. He felt that personal tragedy and anguish was, like, the root of Peter's life as Spider-Man. He felt that was a major component. So he kind of felt like their relationship was, like, too perfect.
Right.
So he felt he had to throw this monkey wrench in Peter's life.
Just cripple her. You know, just cripple her.
So basically do a Barbara Gordon on her?
Yes.
But that's what I love about Spider-Man. If you really think about it, he's the funny guy who jokes and quips in his fights, but he's probably the most, like, tormented hero, at least of that time.
Yes, of that time.
You know, because all he does is carry around guilt, like, 24/7. Like, everything I do, I have to do to, like, fix this.
Yep.
And so this storyline, the night Gwen Stacy died, it gave writers opportunities to throw women off bridges and then... and then later stuff them in fridges.
Bridges and fridges, yo.
Oh, nice. I mean, not nice. Not but you nice, know what I mean.
But yes. But, you know, it allowed you to take chances and say, you know what? We're going to throw a monkey wrench and we might kill off a major character.
Monkey wrenches and fridge-stuffed wenches.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's it for Gwen Stacy's, and which was, like I said, it was an unfortunate thing. And again, still affects Peter Parker to this day, even though they've done these things like, was it Spider-Gwen?
Oh, yeah.
She's an alternate universe
version of Gwen Stacy.
Or it's just as if, I think Peter Parker died and she became Spider-Girl.
Girl, or Spider-Woman.
I don't know what they obviously don't call her Spider-Gwen because that would just give away her identity.
Right.
Hey, Spider-Gwen.
Hey, Stacy, how you doing?
Yeah.
Everybody knows me.
Now, the other thing that happened during the early in the mid-70s was a rejuvenation of one of our, myself and Jared's, favorite team, superhero team, the X-Men.
That's right.
Giant size X-Men number one, 1975. Basically, a nice little reboot. You know,
huge reboot.
They were called the all-new, all-different X-Men, and it really were all-new and all-different because they had some serious diversity in this new group of X-Men. And their mission was to rescue the old, original X-Men. So you had, for one thing, we'll start with everyone's favorite mutant, Wolverine, who debuted in Hulk 181.
Not my mutant.
You know, the Canadian.
So that's what was kind of cool, too. They're bringing in these characters that had already kind of showed up. And also, some of them had already showed up.
Yeah, some of them already had showed up in other places.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you're a prospector, that Hulk 181 is probably going to go up at some point.
Just a bit.
Yeah, this Wolverine guy, I think this Hugh Jackman guy's got his money. I think he knows what he's doing. So watch out for those movies coming your way years ago.
Yeah.
Now, one of your favorite mutants that debuted here, something you can relate to from your culture, Banshee.
Oh,
Sean Cassidy. who debuted first, I think, as a villain in the X-Men.
Yes. Also, Sunfire.
Another guy debuted as a villain, too, I believe.
Interesting.
Yes. Havoc Polaris had a little love in here, too.
Mm-hmm.
But the four main new X-Men characters that debuted was Storm, one of my personal favorites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Egyptian storm god or weather goddess. Nightcrawler, the great holy man from Germany, Kurt Wagner.
Liebchen.
Colossus, Mr. Rasputin from Russia.
Ilyana!
Oh my god. The worst voice acting in animated history.
Yes.
And then last but not least, but the poor fella only lasted three freaking issues, Thunderbird.
Yeah.
Mr. Proudstar.
Thunder the Turf. Native.
Yeah. He
seemed cool.
For some reason, I really dug him. I mean, obviously, like, we got him, and his costume was cool, too.
It was, yeah.
But we got him back because we got his brother. They just, like, recycled, and they're like, Thunderbird didn't die, his brother's here.
Yeah.
And they gave him actually a cooler, you know, story. But, yeah, that was a huge issue.
Len Wein, Dave Cockrum, and a little bit of work on the side and the plotting from Chris Claremont.
Chris Claremont, yeah, who would later take over and do something seminal, something dark.
Yes. But before I even get to that, I want to mention real quick, Storm and Nightcrawler, interestingly enough, we're going to be in DC and be part of the Legion of Superheroes.
That's so random.
From Dave Cockrum.
Really?
Yes, because he had a contract dispute and he was working on that title at the time. But then once things went down, he came to Marvel. He said, okay, I'm going to take these ideas with me. And he introduced them into the new X-Men.
Wow.
So what could have been?
Damn.
What could have been? Can you imagine Storm and Nightcrawler being in the DC universe?
And then I was saying, too, another interesting thing when he brought that up, I was like, well, that makes me think because in X-Men 107, which wasn't too far off from this time, and it was a Cockrum issue, they had the introduction of the Imperial Guard, who are complete carbon copies of Legion of Superhero characters. So I wonder if that was also like a slap in the face of like, well, you guys really should have hired me for that job because now I'm just taking all your characters and putting them in Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and making them cooler.
Yeah.
That's true. Good for him.
But one of the seminal stories real quick in the X-Men storyline was the Dark Phoenix saga.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, many of you who watched the X-Men cartoon of the 90s would be very familiar with it. Basically, Jean Grey.
Scott!
Is possessed by the, you know, the ancient cosmic entity of the Phoenix and is given, you know, godlike power.
Was there a Phoenix, an entity that was a Phoenix before Jean? Or was the Phoenix, is this the first time it's like...
I think that was the first, yeah, no, that was the first time it took a human host.
It took a human host.
Because that's why its behavior was so erratic, because right. it wanted to explore every feeling of being human.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. So it went with rage as a good one.
Well, I think it first started out trying to do good. Save.
But of course, as we know, the reason why was because of your favorite club, the Hellfire Club, Jason Wingard. That's why she flipped out and went crazy. They're trying to manipulate her and eventually pushed her over the edge.
And she famously, and she ends up going on trial for killing, because she killed like one whole planet.
Yeah, a billion people.
The Dabari.
Yeah.
But who looked like cucumber people. It shows him for a second. It's fucked up. It shows like a mother holding her baby or her like toddler, you know, broccoli child. And they're like, and they're just, they look sweet and they're just like, goodbye. And it's like, brah.
Done.
Phoenix. Yeah.
Yep.
It's terrible.
So unfortunately, you know, as the tragedy that unfolds is the loss of those beautiful cucumber people.
Broccoli children dead. But... Yeah,
you know, surprisingly good for your eyes
and healthy.
A big fight between the Imperial Guard and the X-Men, you know, for, you know, the life of Jean Grey.
Yeah.
And then eventually when it's all said and done, Jean Grey just basically takes herself out because she realizes how dangerous.
For a nice steak dinner.
She took herself to Musso and Frank's here in Los Angeles on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yes.
Yeah.
She got classy. Mignon.
She's a classy broad. Yeah.
Yep, you know,
it literally was a saga. Like that whole story was.
Yeah, it was a saga. It went over like 8 or 9 issues.
She's been through some shit.
Yeah,
she's been killed like 50 times.
Yeah,
issues 129 to 130. Yeah, 10 issues. Good lord. Yeah, this carried over 10 issues, and yes, that poor Jean Grey has been through a lot. But what, just much like what happened with Gwen Stacy, how that affected Peter Parker, this would affect the X-Men storyline for many years and decades to come, because that would later set up Madeline Pryor, who is the mother of Cable.
And of course, Mother of Dragons.
Yes.
Wrong thing.
Sure.
Would lead to, you know, the formation of X-Factor, X-Force. I mean, there's so many ramifications that come from this particular storyline.
Well, it was also an original X-Men dying.
Yes, an original X-Men dying.
Yeah.
And because before Jean Grey, you know, she's Jean Grey, but then Jean Grey, they really made her a three-dimensional character.
She was Marvel Girl.
She was Marvel Girl. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Went from Marvel Girl to Phoenix. By the way, she's had so many name changes. It's really weird.
Well, some people even just call her Phoenix from, you know, like they just know her. They just go, oh, that's Phoenix. Nobody ever calls her Marvel Girl.
Right.
Mm-mm. Nope.
But in my day, we called her Marvel Girl.
Yeah, sure.
And we would watch Leave It to Beaver, and we would all be home and eat at dinner. We didn't have our cell phones out, and these times are bullshit.
I remember watching Pleasantville.
Yeah.
And watching William H. Macy look for his dinner.
That's a great
Where's
scene.
My dinner? And he's like, I went home and I thought maybe she'd put one of those TV dinners, but no, there was no dinner.
Such a good movie.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that helped sell the Dark Phoenix saga, as well as other comics of the late 70s, early 80s, was this new thing called a comic book shop, or also known as the direct market.
Is that where we always say we'll see people? We'll see them at
those
things? Yes. Yep.
This was a time where, you know, the comic book publisher decided to do direct market sales. And it made it possible for later, like, smaller publishers like Eclipse Comics and, of course, Epic's actually part of Marvel. But, but any other smaller company and other smaller titled books that come out, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Pacific,
to actually get their stuff sold. Because once you are a direct market retailer, you have to keep the books, where the traditional newsstands, they could send them back.
So this was the birth of the comic shop.
Yes, it was the birth of the comic
shop. So this also
shop.
Shows the popularity of comics and how much in the mainstream they were, that they would deserve their own store.
Shop, right.
Yeah. That's amazing, yeah.
And it's a lovely thing that even though video stores have died off, there's still comic shops popping up, like new ones.
Right.
Yeah.
Still.
And this is where the back issue market would start to play in, because as you said, they have to keep their product.
Yes,
so,
they keep their products.
You know, any good business person is just going to be like, well, throw it out the back. They're going to be like, just put it in the back right now.
Right.
And then later on.
Magic happens.
Yeah, they probably didn't even mean to sit on it.
Nope.
Completely. Yeah. It was so not by choice. Yeah. Which is probably why every now and then you see like this immaculate condition of a book that you're like, how is that in that good of condition? It's because, it was probably sitting in some dude's warehouse for God knows how long, in great condition, you know, just never sold.
Oh, sorry to interrupt, everyone. Just wanted to mention real quick about a shop in Canoga Park, California, called Spiro's Heroes. Elliot, the proprietor of the store, has over 300,000 books in what's called the Temple of Comics. That's Spiro Heroes in Canoga Park, spirosheroes.com.
And the other thing was great to have these comic book shops. This would also lead to my last thing I'm going to talk about is the company crossovers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you had the Secret Wars.
Secret Wars was epic. That was actually one of the first books I remember consciously as a kid, as a collector, seeing, like, because I knew the superheroes, but seeing that Secret Wars books going like, they're all in the same book. Jared Likey. Jared want this book.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was the first time you would see all your favorite characters combined into one major story arc.
Mm-hmm.
And also that would have ramifications down the road, because obviously what's the most famous thing that came out of Secret Wars?
Some black alien?
Yes.
The symbios.
Right. Yeah. It became Venom later.
Venom. As we say in the fancy
Wasn't the first Marvel crossover, wasn't it Contest of Champions?
Yes, before that, indeed, Contest of Champions,
which
was
is
the
good.
First official.
That's a good one, yeah.
But the one that most people are familiar with, of course, is Secret Wars.
And, unfortunately, Secret Wars 2.
Yes, yes.
With the
Jerry Curl, the Jerry Curl Beyonder, yeah. Human Beyonder. But one thing that was cool also around that same time, but even before, a little bit before that, but kind of missed from the late 70s to the early 80s, was the DC Marvel crossovers. Superman versus Spider-Man, X-Men, Teen Titans,
but alas, ones. That was for another time.
Yeah.
Yes, that'll be for another time to talk about, but just wanted to mention that. But we're so happy to conclude the Bronze Age Marvel history. Please subscribe. Go to YouTube.
I'm not happy. I want to keep going.
Let's go more Marvel.
I'm going to talk about every issue of Marvel 2 and 1. Are you ready?
Marvel, yeah. Yes. In issue number 1...
The Thing teams up with this other character.
Yes, and this other character is not quite as cool as the Thing. And the Thing wins. In issue 2...
I'm out of breath.
Anyway, yeah, find us on Facebook.
Instagram.
We do SmackDown Sundays. Mm-hmm. We do fun things on Instagram, post pictures, ask you what your thoughts are and feelings. Same thing on Facebook.
Videos. We have little videos of things that we shoot.
On YouTube. Yeah. Find us on the tubes of you.
Yeah.
We're on there, and please subscribe to us on iTunes. We're lovely on there as well.
And we'll also see you at these new comic shops that are sprouting up now. Direct sales, people. Comic shops.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.